Hello and welcome to Recovery Internet Radio, broadcast live and direct from Straight Stuff Studios, Sunday night, every Sunday night at 7 o'clock. Thanks for joining us. We've got a great show for you this evening. You are tuning in to episode number, you know what, I can't even BS anymore. I lost count a long time ago.
We get up every week.
Yeah. Can we just say, I said 100 last week, but we're probably about 100 still. Give or take. We're in our second wonderful year of broadcasting and getting to share stories with some really amazing people, and that's exactly what we plan on doing tonight. So thanks for joining us. I'm going to introduce our host this week and every week, the man with the plan, Mr. Rick Atwater.
The man with the plan. That's me. That's the man with the plan. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, let's see, it would be, so I think we actually started doing this in I want to say the end of February.
It was a cold, dark evening in February.
It was a cold and windy night.
It was
yeah,
a long,
so,
frosty winter.
Yeah, so we're closing in on 2 years mm-hmm. of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So well,
congratulations.
Yeah, I mean it's been fun. We've really met a lot of interesting folks and done a lot of fun things. So welcome to the show, Straight Stuff on Addictions. Our tag tonight is intervention, getting them to the door. It doesn't necessarily mean in the door, although in Brian's case, maybe it does. We'll talk about that.
Sometimes carrying them.
Sometimes carrying them. Sometimes dragging them. Whatever it takes. But thanks for joining us tonight.
Welcome.
Where we are every Sunday night at 7, as Chris said. And thanks to Chris for engineering this thing. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Brian, for coming out on this cold evening.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can call in if you have any questions by calling 323-792-2977. We're always happy to answer your questions if you have any. And you can also tweet us live at Rick Atwater if you would rather tweet us. We can get those tweets live. Is
tweet,
that right?
Tweet. Yeah, I'll be checking.
Okay. Chris will check the tweets.
It's just part
of
my...
It sounds so strange to say that, but, you know. Check the tweets.
For those kids out there, they know what we're talking about.
And also, please remember to check out recoveryinternetradio.com.
Ooh, recoveryinternetradio.com, your source for all things recovery. Please
visit us. That's right. And we will, if we do any promos tonight, we'll do them at halftime. Because I really do want to talk to you, Brian, about some stuff.
Okay.
So I guess the first thing is, well, you and I have known each other a long time, but haven't seen each other for a very long time. And you just started. I think you emailed me. I don't know.
About a month ago, I sent you an email.
Yeah.
Our journey started 18, almost 17 and a half years ago through an outreach call made by my mom to you. And I was out there in my alcoholism and drug dependency, insanity, and you held my mom's hand, and I'm grateful for you for doing what you did for my parents while I was making a decision on whether I want to live or die.
Right.
And
I bet you weren't that grateful at the time.
No, I wasn't. I was pretty angry with you because you were getting into my into my party materials.
It was cutting into your drinking time there, I think, a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But so then you kind of, you know, dropped off the map. I never really knew what happened to you, and then I heard from you. I think we corresponded maybe once a while back, email back and forth once or twice, or I saw you on Facebook or something.
It was about 8 years ago when I again expressed my gratitude on an anniversary day, probably at the 8 or 9 mark of my recovery.
Yes,
expressing and reflecting and thanking everybody that was involved in my life early on in my sobriety. And since that time, a whole lot has happened, and ultimately I end up in the northwest suburbs again in Chicago doing things that I have a passion for, and I think we're going to discuss that a little bit this evening.
I would most certainly hope that we get to that, but I wanted to start with how this thing unfolded. I guess this is called...
A little bit of experience, strength, and hope,
that'd be a good
sharing
way
where I was and
what
happened and what I'm doing today.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, without going into any great detail, Rick, I had to go on almost an 18-year journey of a mental, emotional, and chemical dependency. It was a long journey, and it almost took my life 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I can... I can take you on a quick journey. Early on in grade school and junior high, and it really started flaring up in high school, I had a romance with the alcohol. Mm. And I grew up with a semi-functional family. It was a basic nuclear family, mom, dad,
mm-hmm.
sister, brother. Dad was working and mom didn't work. We grew up in middle-class America, and certain things within family systems happen and enabling kicks in. And during that time in my life, I was pretty insecure emotionally with some things in my life personally. And I fell in love with the alcohol,
mm.
and I set down everything that I camouflaged that I had a passion for. That was the tennis racket and my passion for automobiles, and soon it turned into a passion for blondes and Miller Lite and being 18 miles away from the
right.
from the Illinois border, and being at that age where I could disappear over the border at 18
yeah,
and still be in high
it,
school.
Yeah, 18 at that, at
my
that
parents
time.
Doing what my parents needed to do mm. to keep me from going across that border by allowing things to happen that shouldn't have happened a long time ago.
Mm.
That was the precursor to things. But I'm one of those corporate guys
mm.
that found his way to corporate America, and I had some very enabling employers that allowed things to go on that happened in the metalworking industry. And I worked in high-end corporate America for 17 years, and ultimately...
you said you were an engineer?
I was an engineer. I designed brake spring applications for all the major foreign and American automobile companies,
mm-hmm.
some of which the platforms are out there.
Yeah.
I don't like to admit, but I was under the influence. So when you when you press your brake pedal, think of Brian when you're trying to stop.
It's not ice, dude.
But they've been cycle test time and time again.
Yeah.
On track, so we're okay.
Yeah, it's okay. We've talked to some pilots.
Yeah, you can talk to the pilots.
It could be worse, yeah.
But I was one of those alpha-functioning alcoholics that that functioned well throughout a strong percentage of my life. But as things happen with this disease, my tolerance went through the roof and was significantly marked in high school. All my high school buddies were down for the count when I was still looking for another $40 to get another kegger, and the sun's coming up. I just was
right.
nonstop. Yeah. Fast forward to corporate America and the tail end, the tolerance was significant, and co-managing the withdrawal from the alcohol, making my way to the doctor solicitation, specifically the psychiatrist that could work the benzodiazepine piece.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it really took off at the tail end. It was a
What years would that be?
Meaning years.
Like what year was that? Like in the
1996 to 98 is when I really
just,
accelerated
down. I was just thinking
down.
In my mind what the benzo du jour was at that time.
Mm-hmm. The benzo du jour was Klonopin. And the Xanax.
Yeah, Xanax.
And it wasn't as readily available off the streets. And with the Food and Drug Administration and the loose scribing and not having to solicit a doctor every 30 days to get your prescriptions on a Schedule II narcotic, I was doing the doctor game.
Mm.
I had four doctors that were supplying me the benzodiazepines. I'm not a stimulant drug person. I was really romancing the alcohol and the benzo, and I like that type of buzz.
Yeah, the floaty thing.
The floaty thing. Mm-hmm. I did play around with the cocaine in the 80s, and
mm-hmm.
I didn't like that type of buzz.
I really
found my romance with the alcohol and the benzos.
Yeah, yeah, and it's interesting that you describe it like a romance, because that's,
mm-hmm.
that's pretty...
It was a romance.
That's
and
pretty
it was
accurate,
a,
isn't it?
It was a romance that took me on a journey of consequences, and towards the tail end of my bottom, as things happened with DUI number one and DUI number two and DUI number three and DUI number four in the matter of 28 months and going through the cycle of criminal justice system and fighting that battle of do I want to surrender and accept or do I want to keep going and eventually die or go to jail.
Were you in Florida at that time?
No, I was in the Chicagoland area. Mm-hmm. I drove my corporate Cadillac through my neighbor's living room in DuPage County, and that was DUI number one back in 1997.
Yeah.
And doing the geographical move that alcoholics do out of guilt and shame, and losing that high-profile job in Chicago, working with a competitor that got me down to central Indiana.
So it got you out of the neighborhood?
Got me out of the neighborhood, got me out of that insanity, and I...
What did you think at that time? Did you think it was going to be, that was going to make the difference?
Well, you know, as we do with chameleons and addiction, is nothing ever happened there. It was a non-event, and...
Yeah,
I'm going to have this corporation pay my retention for a headhunting fee, and the moving van's going to show up, and I'm going to move, and all of that's gone. It's over. But I only lasted 30 days dry, and the insanity started cycling with back-to-back DUIs in 1 week, and sitting in a Cass County jail in central Indiana with a blood alcohol content of 0.682. And 40 milligrams of Klonopin in my bloodstream.
That sounds like a possible world record.
Not something to do on your first day.
That tells you where my tolerance was at and where I took my addiction.
Yeah.
And eventually what happened in that county jail is I did seize and I did go into a coma. And I woke up 2.5 weeks later in the psych ward across the street from the jail asking the nurse, where am I and what's going on? And her explaining to me that you shouldn't even be speaking, and 20 minutes later, I'm cuffed and back in jail.
Hmm. How much time did you spend there?
I spent 1 month in there without a bond, and 1 month later, I got 2 surety bonds for $100,000, and the good old bail bondsman, Bruce Harris in mid-central Indiana, came and got me after he heard my story in the jail, and he bonded me out, and couple more court appearances under the influence and getting the pressure that you need to get out of town, I did do the flight risk thing, and I left for a couple months, and now a warrant is out for my arrest. And on Thanksgiving morning, there's a little fax sent to my parents' condo in Sarasota, Florida from my bondsman. I've got 100 guys down there, Brian. You better enjoy your turkey dinner and get on a plane and take care of your matters. And that I did. And once I made my way back in front of the judge, they forfeited my bond. And back in jail, I sat for another month and a half thinking about things. But I was sober at that time.
Before you went in?
The second time, correct.
Yeah. Not permanently, though.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, long story short, that's when I decided to make the change and solicit this program that saved my life. And thinking about it with an orange monkey suit on, from Hugo Boss suits to, what is that, gentleman that's, what's his name? Bob Barker. All of the jail materials, from a night suit to an orange suit.
Orange jumpsuit,
thinking about things and getting through things,
Would you call that a judicial intervention?
I would call it a judicial intervention, correct.
Uh-huh.
But it was a 17-year run of brutal insanity, and I'm grateful that I saved my life. And like I said, Rick, I'm grateful for you working with my parents during the time that I was soliciting getting well.
Yeah.
But I just had to go on that 18-month.
Yeah.
Let's say
you were in Florida
there
for a while. You got sober in Florida, right?
Well, actually, when I made it through my legal matters in Florida, I still had to get through one legal intervention in Illinois.
Yeah.
And that's the DUI in DuPage County after driving my Cadillac through my neighbor's living room. I made my way to Naples, Florida. I've been detoxed so many times in treatment centers, and I've been to so many primary cares and IOPs and all different levels of care. And I had a very good friend of mine that I went to high school with, and I spent almost a year down there working with my hands because I couldn't even think with my head because of the neuroscience damage I did with the alcohol and the benzo piece. And I knew I had one more consequence that I had to get through, and that's face this DUI in DuPage County. And I did do what I needed to do, and it was either go to the penitentiary for 6 years and serve three, negotiated it down from 3 to 1, and I made my way to my sentencing, and I did walk away with a misdemeanor and a couple years of probation and another 75 hours of counseling, but I sat in their county jail for 90 days.
In DuPage?
In DuPage.
Yeah.
And it was during that time I was entering a school in Chicago for my CADC, substance abuse, basic counseling.
Where did you get that? Where did you go?
I went to St. Augustine College in Chicago before I migrated into DePaul University to get my education with what I do out here today.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where you got your CADC?
Got my CADC at St. Augustine.
So like from the jail cell in DuPage, what's the thinking? Let's just say you've had plenty of experience with treatment, like more hours, you know, than we could probably count.
Mm-hmm.
You've had plenty of experience with detox and all that other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the, you know, I mean, everybody doesn't decide to become an alcoholism counselor from that position.
Well, let me share a story with you, Rick. My parents were at a conference in San Francisco, and my grandmother from Milwaukee was down watching my sister and I, and this was when I was in the fourth grade, and there was a social science question that was kind of psychology based on what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah.
And this is after I was acting out and painted my ceiling black and my walls red and the back Sabbath posters and the neon lights going on. And I opened up the book, and one question was, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah.
And I wrote down in the fourth grade, I want to help people.
Really?
So that seed, that vocation was
set. Yeah.
And it sat dormant. And my father is from corporate America, and I have no resentment towards him saying you must go to corporate America and work, but in my self, I've always wanted to be the type of person that wanted to help.
Yeah.
And it's,
so that was in there.
It was in there.
Anyway.
It was deep. The seed was deep.
Yeah.
And it didn't germinate until 20-some-odd years later, and based on my life experience, I decided that I'm going to germinate the seed and fertilize the seed and get educated around my experience and help people in some capacity with substance abuse and mental health and co-occurring and things of that nature. Well, what I did is I got on a research team with DePaul University on extended care, and it's a Paul Molloy Democratic Oxford House model, and that's how I got into...
Say a little bit something about what that is.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of people out there that might not understand that.
So it's a peer-to-peer support model of sober living, transitional living, extended care, but basically in that arena it's called sober living. Paul Molloy was a attorney in the White House that had a problem with the drink and fell to his knees in a dumpster behind the White House, and he started getting well with four guys, and they moved into a home, and D.C. lost funding for the home that they were in, and he was going through a divorce, and his wife gratefully gave them the residence, and they started this Oxford House group, and today there's close to 1,900 Oxford houses across the country, and basically what it is a democratic peer-to-peer support model of getting well. Its tuition rate is very competitive from a price standpoint, and you've got to be really motivated to want to get well, and there's rules and regulations and guidelines, and one of those basic big rules and guidelines, don't drink and don't drug, and demonstrate some responsibility, and we'll help you along the way. So,
and when you say peer to peer, it's peer operated, the homes themselves, or
correct. There's a house manager that's had some tenure in their recovery. You abide to the rules, the regulations, the guidelines, and the stipulations, and the peers are at different stages and different tenures of their recovery. And where one is falling, the other peer in the home or house member, if you want to substitute the word, we'll pick them up. And it's a 12-step based model, AANA, Al-Anon, or Alateen on the exterior. But, it's a 12-step requirement that you've got to meet.
And mm-hmm. so that's what you were, you were involved in some research around
right.
that particular model.
Dr. Jason Leonard and Dr. Joseph Ferrari and a group of clinical and community psychologists that were doing their PhD at DePaul wrote a grant through NIDA and NIH and got an $18 million grant to do research on the Oxford House models. And during that time, they were pulling data on outcomes of participants in the home. That was one ingredient. And then we were also responsible for fighting this Fair Housing Act of 1988 on communities not wanting to have addicts and alcoholics living in their subdivisions where there was a Oxford home in their subdivision. And basically, we lobbied and fought the stereotype and the stigmatism that's associated to addiction and addiction recovery. And
talk about how you did that. I mean, what, like, did you talk to community groups? Did you go to the neighborhoods? Did you...
We talked to the community groups, went to the neighborhoods, solicited the neighbors, actually ended up in court on multiple occasions fighting the community on zoning and what needed to be done. And
did you have any luck with that?
Yes, we did. Every single solitary lawsuit that we have encountered, we won.
And what do you attribute that to? I mean, good lawyers, or did you have God on your side, or how did it work?
I think once the neighborhood, well, here's a case in point. I started a sober living environment in Chicago called Fresh Start Sober Living. It was a 36-guy program, which is 119 beds in the city of Chicago. It's an urban model. We bought two gravestones on Potomac and Rockwell on the west side of Chicago, which is not a happy place, and there was a whole lot of unhappy things going on with gangbanging and drug dealing and all of that. And we buy these two properties, rehab these two properties. It was District 12 with the Chicago police set up on districts in Chicago, and we were fought tooth and nail by the drug addicts and the drug dealers and the gangbangers, but specifically the people that were seeing the change in community and purchasing property, and next thing you know, there's drug addicts and alcoholics living in these homes, getting well, planting flowers, cutting grass, manicuring, pruning, and those two homes were the prettiest homes on the street, and next thing you know, community was surrendering and accepting to the stereotype and the stigma. These guys are leaving and going to work and coming home, and crime had dropped 22% in a four-block radius, and next thing you know, the scrutiny went away.
Yeah, and would you say that was a common theme?
Common theme. Yeah. It just takes time for your neighbors and your friends and everything that you view on TV or listen to on the radio, that a person that has a needle in their arm or a paper bag living underneath the viaduct, everybody needs to understand this disease doesn't discriminate or stereotype.
Right.
There are every single solitary walk of life.
Mm-hmm.
And
so the guy with the paper bag under the bridge could be your family physician.
Exactly.
That's a scary thought.
just for
the sake of, you know. So did you, how about the suburban situation with that, with the Fair Housing Act, getting recovery homes in suburban areas? Were you able to do that?
Well, it's still to this day, it all depends on what region of the country, the state of California up and down the coast, and with their zoning criteria is pretty liberal. There are certain sections within the state, but there are so many treatment centers in the state of Florida, and with GARF and JACO, and that is a credentialing through quality control and what you can and cannot do. There's just so many sober living environments up and down the state, and throughout the 17 years when that boom was accelerating and all of the research and outcomes on what happens and that was going on. And in New England, blue-collar states, they were mirroring what they were doing in the state of California, and state of Florida, state of Arizona started getting into the sober living, extended care, transitional living, and it became a movement, Rick. People were seeing that people were getting well,
right.
or there was not that thought or premise that I've got a drug addict living next door.
Right. How about in Illinois? What do you know about the climate here?
In the state of Illinois, well, there are some pretty awesome, we call it sober living environments in the city of Chicago. And what's happening in the suburbs now is treatment is really putting a strong push that the bridge to getting well is through sober living, extended care, transitional living, whatever you want to call it. And over and above the work that I do today with interventions across the country helping kids get into treatment, I started a young adult male program on 35 acres in mid-central Illinois called Invictus Woods. But still to this day, you get into the upper income communities where our crisis of our economy in the last 10 years has crashed, and you get people that want to give back in their own way. And it's happening, but it's still somewhat not accepted. If you really want it, you got to get it. And you got to demonstrate.
I guess it's a little bit puzzling to me that people, correct me if I'm wrong, but people seem to have a stereotype that, you know, they say alcoholic and drug addict, they don't get the difference between a practicing alcoholic and a recovering alcoholic. First of all, it's a pretty significant difference. And so they have the idea that there's going to be, you know, people hanging around the door and drug deals going down in their neighborhood and all that stuff. I think that's what they think.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
That is true. And to get through that, it takes time. It takes time for the neighbors that are peeking through the windows or pulling out of the driveway looking for orange caps or hypodermic needles around their grass, that there's a group of people living across the street that are maintaining property and aesthetics of the property probably tenfold over what they are, and
right.
they're leaving in nice high-end vehicles going to work, and they're paying their bills, and there are no pink slips in front of the doors for utility companies shutting power down. And next thing you know, they're barbecuing together, and they're enjoying life together, and that's where they're at.
So that's what it takes. It just takes it takes
patience
time
and persistence and demonstration that we are people that have had a pretty insane past through addiction and the consequences of, but you need to let go of where we were and who we were, and this is who we can become.
Do you know what, I don't know if I talked to you about this. Do you know anything about this movie, The Anonymous People, did I mention that to you?
Yes, it's all across the country, coast to coast. Have you seen it, Rick?
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah, and that's kind of, in a way, that's kind of what we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's about the recovery movement and people seeing, you know,
it's a very,
undoing the stigma.
It's a very powerful instrument, and anybody in this audience that is listening to it, I strongly encourage you to see that movie, The Anonymous People. It's a direct correlation of what we're discussing this evening,
right.
on what can happen with people of all walks of life.
Let me do
and what
quick,
they can
do
with their
plug,
lives.
Because we're gonna do a showing of that.
Awesome.
We have a copy,
mm-hmm.
and we're gonna do a showing on the 22nd of January at the Dole Mansion in Crystal Lake in the listening room.
Ah.
So if you want, you can just come, there'll be a flyer, and I'll give times and dates of the next week. But the 22nd of January, the listening room, and I'll make sure that the time becomes available when the flyers come out. We'll put it on the website too.
Sounds good.
Yeah,
that Dole Mansion is a beautiful place.
Yeah, it is. It is a cool place. So I mean, it'll be a great. There's several other places where we're also going to show the. We're going to show it at Woodstock North for parents and students, and we're going to show it one other place. I'm not sure yet. The Mental Health Board, probably. So,
I think that movie needs to be put into high school where parents and upper-end communities, so they can get a good understanding
of this movement
across the country.
There's guys like you and I that have been doing the destigmatization work, if that's even a word. It sounds really good, though.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying.
I know exactly.
For a long time, without having really had a name for it, just advocating for recovery and talking about the positive aspects of recovery rather than, you know, the down and out, And the only reason we talk about, you know, like you started, we started tonight with your story is to give people hope. Because, you know, there's people out there that have had those kinds of experiences. And here you are doing all the things that you're doing, which is
it's really a fascinating beautiful. Life, and recovery is very cool.
Yeah. All right, let's do this. Let's take a break. We'll take about 5 minutes. What are we gonna do, Chris?
I got to give thanks to our special guest co-engineer tonight, Tanya, for helping select our song this evening.
what do we got?
We're listening to a little track by a band called Muse.
Okay.
And the name of the track is called Madness. So,
yeah. All right.
We
how appropriate.
Figure out how that goes right into the theme here.
Yeah, we'll work it in the second half.
However you need it. So,
all right.
Thanks for being with us tonight. Enjoy the music. We'll be back with you in 5.
Can't get these memories out of my mind, and some kind of madness. Oh, I tried so hard to let you go, but some kind of
thanks for being with us tonight. I hope you enjoyed. If you needed to run to the little boys or girls room during the break, then that was good timing. But thanks for being here tonight with us on Recovery Internet Radio. We've been having a very interesting conversation so far, as we sometimes do. I'd like to get back to it here. Again, if you haven't met him before, Mr. Rick Atwater will be guiding us this evening, as mm-hmm. he's been doing. You can always reach us at recoveryinternetradio.com for all our archive shows and links. Please check us out. There's a link there. You could join our mailing list if you'd like to get reminders for our episodes every week. Check that out. Do we have any promos this week?
Let's just we have a lot to talk about. Let's just go for it this
yeah.
week, shall we?
Deal.
Okay.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, what I wanted to do, like we said, Brian, what I want to do is so I know you were doing research work with DePaul, and then you opened up your own recovery home in the city.
It wasn't exactly my own recovery home in the city. I met another gentleman on 2100 North Lincoln Park Alano Club.
Mm.
He was lost, okay. felt deserted. Just came out of 26th and California drug court. And as you do in sobriety, you're sitting in that steel chair that you earned the privilege to have a cold ass and eventually warm it up, right? And starts what's his connection? And I connected with this young man whose mom was a realtor in Chicago, and he was a recovering heroin and cocaine addict, and his parents had some of the property avenues for us to get
yeah.
involved. And
yeah.
My partner,
you had the model and the mind.
And the model and the mind, and doing the research out of DePaul, and his motivation was, I don't want to sleep with, I want to start a model of recovery that doesn't guilt and shame a young man or a young gal or adult, whatever it has to be, that I want to have pillows and TVs and a nice kitchen and couch. And
you shouldn't be punished for having a disease.
Medium to high-end things. And
yeah.
keep it at a very competitive price
mm-hmm.
rather than me going through drug court and living with cockroaches and all of that. So
yeah.
that was one of the precursors in our business plans
mm-hmm.
to give that type of aesthetic environment to the recovering
and
people.
What was the name of that place?
It's called Fresh Start Sober Living.
Fresh Start
mm-hmm.
Sober Living. Is it? And are they still up and running? Or the
yeah, there's a 119-bed program. There's
yeah.
Greystones and flats, and they also have a really nice high-end home up in Glencoe
mm.
for the business type of executive that wants to maintain his lifestyle and
mm-hmm.
things. And it's still $125 to $175 a week.
Mm.
And it's called Fresh Start Sober Living.
Okay. And so I just want to get through that part of it and
mm-hmm.
then talk a little bit about, because I know that one of the big parts of what you've done is interventions.
Great.
Yeah,
so while I was a student at DePaul, I really got into family systems and family
yeah.
systems theory, and with drug addiction and working in the treatment industry, it's all about taking a family on a journey and taking them to the point of origin in their family mm-hmm. history to kind of discover and assess and kind of probe into why the person we're going to intervene on is not so happy and medicating with drugs and alcohol or behavior or cutting or eating or a whole grocery list of things that can happen to people that grow up in
yeah.
significantly dysfunctional home environments. So coming from corporate America and not having to commute to work and work in an office, that wasn't like what I wanted to do. And when I was getting my CADC, I worked in an agency on the west side called Healthcare Alternative Solutions,
mm.
With the referrals coming out of 26 in California. It was a Hispanic type of referral
mm-hmm.
environment, and I loved their culture. And
mm-hmm.
I started doing some basic counseling and the biopsychosocial assessments, and that's an assessment tool we use to
mm-hmm.
start to develop a treatment plan and come up with a diagnosis and a summary of what we're going to do.
And it fits very well with the family systems
exactly.
model, because you get all that information about
right.
family and history, et cetera.
But yeah. while I was a student at DePaul, I was privy to a whole lot of data sets on what treatment centers are doing across the country, whether it's 12-step or holistic or wellness or a medical model or community model, all the different models that are out there. And I stumbled across a treatment center that the marketing person was in Chicago, and I actually had lunch with that person in Chicago, explained to her who I was doing, where I was going, and what I wanted to do, and why I didn't want to work in a treatment center facilitating groups and this or that. I want to work on the acute side, get into the hot seat, get into the trenches, and 42 days later, I get that first referral, and I'm on a jet plane to Manhattan. Pretty frightened, pretty scared, but knowing I've got a diploma in my back pocket and some education on models of intervention,
right.
Family systems, systemic, the ARISE, the crisis model, all of that in my head, and I did it, and next thing you need her. 7 years later, it's a few hundred cases down under my belt, and it's a passion that I have, and it's all good.
So I think people would be interested to know a little bit about what the dynamics of an intervention, of the type of intervention. Well, actually, I have a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, we talked about all these different models of
mm-hmm.
treatment, and more than likely, you know, most people that are listening wouldn't have a clue about what, you know, models of what models of treatment, you know, how are we supposed to know what, you know, should the general public know about models of treatment and what, or is there, would you say there's certain types of models that fit certain types of individuals, or is one better than the other, or?
You're asking a whole lot of questions, and a whole lot of families across the country, of which there's 6.5 out of 10 families that had something serious going on underneath the roof of their homes.
Sure.
They're seeing their loved ones not behaving properly or acting out, and things are going on and so forth. They get on the internet, they start soliciting, where can I go for help, and they get
right.
caught up in that gosh darn treatment maze, and they don't know if people like us that are out there that help a family navigate through that treatment maze. And
well, that's what I really
exactly.
wanted to get to. You would be the kind of person that would be the general contractor for that job.
Right. So what would happen is families start hitting all of the phone numbers, the 800 numbers, and they're calling treatment centers, and they're sharing a little bit about the family history on, you know, why can't I get Jim or Johnny into this treatment center, and all of this is going on, and we've done this and done that, and it's like, well, maybe you need somebody that can step into the family and take a peek at both sides of the equation.
And
help
decide
you.
Sort out what needs to be done. And who,
exactly.
Yeah.
So basically what people like us do that help families in crisis via intervention is we talk to the family, get an understanding and idea of what's going on with the family and what's going on with the person that is medicating or self-harming, so on and so forth. And while all of that is going on, people like us travel across the country and visit hundreds of treatment centers and get educated on what milieu they work. And the more you zero in on the family history and get an understanding of what's going on in their life and where they're at in their life and what model would potentially work or what is really going on, then we start zeroing in the hundreds that are lighting up off the internet and come up with three or four and work out what we need to work out.
See, because I think most people don't understand that an intervention, a person that does interventions like yourself, does a lot more than just sit in a circle and read your letter to
I want to throw it out there.
Son.
What you see on TV with reality TV and intervention, what you see is what you see.
Right.
What you get with what we do, me personally and hundreds of us that are across this country, it is very professional, it's very personal, it's very private, it's very ethical, and it's very thought through. There are literally 200 hours that go through our minds before we even approach the person that is wanting not to have help at that juncture in time and getting them
sure.
prepped to work through that stage of getting them motivated for help during that private moment.
And that one private moment
mm-hmm.
is what most people think of as intervention. They
right.
don't think of all the stuff that goes
the average intervention getting to that person
yeah.
is 25-30 minutes, but there's a couple hundred hours of work on the upfront.
And the other thing that impressed me when we were talking when we had breakfast the other day, we were talking about the stuff that you, how you stayed with the person all the way into treatment and then you stayed with the family, what did you say, eight months?
Mm-hmm. So when you want to talk about outcomes, and I'm sure
right.
one of your questions is how successful are you, So naturally what we do is we do the assessment piece, mm-hmm. and it's not a clinical, it's just a hearing what's going on.
Right.
Families adapt to the insanity of the disease, and they play certain roles, whether you're enabling, caretaking, mascotting, scapegoating, so on and so forth. That addict alcoholic has got your family so positioned and so pinned in a corner to do whatever they need to do. And once you've identified what's going on with what the family's doing as a whole, there's a reason why that is happening. And a good intervention is getting the family to recognize what roles they've taken. Don't pivot into the person that is suffering. Take responsibility a little bit for what you've done to enable this whole mess. And 9 out of 10 times you don't get an interventionist in a hotel room or in a home or in an employer's office to have these delicate conversations. But there's pre-intervention the day before. I like to get and meet with the family and break bread with the family and come up with 3-4 key individuals, and always that second individual is going to have the emotional charge on that person, and come up with the model that we want to work. A lot of opiate boys in their mid-20s that are in the corporate world don't like to be thunderstruck and catapulted out. It's called an ARISE model of intervention, where you invite that person into the meeting and letting them know that you're not leaving town for a period of time until things are thoroughly discussed, right? And
those are the words you use. Mm-hmm. We want to thoroughly discuss a few
things
with you.
Thoroughly discuss.
You do a lot of, you mentioned the young opiate boys in the corporate world.
Right.
Is that a population that you spend, is that something that you kind of, that's a special
right.
area for you?
You're in this field and a lot longer than I've been in this field, and a strong percentage of my interventions up until about 3.5-4 years ago were all pretty much alcohol interventions, and something serious that is going on across this country, and that's the prescription drug epidemic and the opiate epidemic, and a whole cluster of things that are happening with those two. And
related, I assume.
Related. And as you know, these drugs and narcotics and even the cannabis out here is so potent and powerful over and above what it's been 20 years ago. And what happens in the developing mind at the early stages of teenage and young adult life, and you get these substances playing with your brain and adapting your brain and working your brain and doing things that the neuroscience of the brain can do when you're doing things. These kids are going down at a very accelerated pace. The average cycle of an alcoholic in the past was 14, 15 years. These kids are crashing out at 18, 23.
Right.
With nothing to look forward to in life.
Right.
When they do
the
decide to get
the bottom
well,
is four or five years.
It is so accelerated.
Maybe not even that long.
It's very scary.
Yeah. So you work a lot with that population.
Right.
So.
I like working with, I don't know what it is, Rick, and you're probably going to ask that question, why do you have such success working with that population? I can't honestly answer you why. With the exception that I can go to my teenage state of my brain in the blink of an eyelash. And
yeah, you can relate to them.
I have the gift to connect with these boys, and I don't give up on these boys. And, you know, to get their hope instilled in a matter of 20 seconds when you do an intervention, be very empathetic to the situation.
Yeah, you have to know what it's like. And
exactly. But something that I don't do is I don't self-disclose when I'm doing an intervention, because how in the world is the person going to look at you when they're in their insanity? Like, I'll never be at your level. So
yeah, it would be too scary for them.
Too scary, way too scary. I stay right at their level. And
yeah.
When I do the intervention, after the intervention, the family members or the loved ones leave, and that's when we have this heart-to-heart conversation. And what do we need to do to get from point A to point B? Because certain substances out here today can take your life in a withdrawal, and we just navigate our day accordingly.
And so we have, I'm not leaving until we fully discuss some things.
All right.
Thoroughly.
Thoroughly.
Right. Using the key word, I like that. So
I guess that's setting a boundary, right?
I guess it is. It's kind of like in a very firm but gentle way. Yeah.
Setting some guidelines here.
But okay, and then you stay with, so And then one of the questions was, do you do the transport? You arrange for the transport?
Right.
Or how does that work?
When I work with the family, and that was a good question, my success working with families across this country today, I don't do the pre-intervention, and I don't do the intervention and leave the family in disarray of fear, anxiety, and all of that confusion that's happening. It's thoroughly discussed what's going to happen throughout the course of treatment, so on.
So everybody knows exactly what's going on.
Everybody's on the same page.
Yeah.
And once I do facilitate the intervention, I will transport the patient to the treatment center, and 9 times out of 10, it's straight to a level 5 detox for a period of time before they migrate into a level 4, which is primary. And you're not going into an individual's home knowing that you're probably working with a person that's not abusing a substance that has crossed the line to chemical dependency.
You pretty much know that going.
You pretty much know,
so you know
that you're going to need a detox
in
some shape, form.
So you know that's the next stop. And do you do that transport personally? Or
I do the transport personally. Uh-huh. I work with some pretty cool treatment centers that I've got one phone, and I've got a medical team real close by, and I've got treatment centers that greet me at the airport with their transportation. I take their transportation to the treatment center, and I park myself that evening in a hotel after our loved one is safe in detox, and I make my way to the treatment center the following morning, and I give all of the 411 on the family history so they can get some collateral. And the first 2 weeks, a good question that I'm going to answer for you is
that I haven't even answered
rate.
Yet, but it's good because you're thinking ahead.
You work with treatment centers that are called intervention family or friendly because you bring somebody to treatment that's gone through detox the first 7 days and they slide over. They're not going to like their interventionist too much, and they're going to start challenging on, I'm okay, I'm shaving, I'm eating, I look good, I feel good, and this is fun, but I want to come home, or I want to go back to work, and I'm really angry at this guy that helped me. And in treatment today, knowing in certain times with certain drugs that we're working with, you're going to have that moment where the loved one is going to want to come home, and we work through that delicate moment again.
So intervention friendly is a treatment center that wouldn't buy the manipulative drug addict saying that bad man made me come here.
Exactly.
Okay, just so I'm clear.
Yeah.
There are those out there.
The successful outcomes in what we do in recovery today with extended care models and good people like ourselves that work with the family after their loved one is engaging back into community. And like I said, Rick,
do you see them back into, or?
I don't see them directly. I see a lot of it over Skyping and over the phone. And you do enough cases throughout the course of time. Every single solitary family is educated in family education with the treatment centers that I work with for 4 or 5 days. And
do you stick pretty close to the ones that usually do family programs in their treatment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's part of the deal.
As long as I have that release signed, I stay glued.
Yeah.
But I don't get involved with the patient's treatment, and I don't get involved with the whole family's treatment.
Does the treatment center usually do the aftercare planning? Are you involved in that?
That's the success. There's so much exciting things going on across the country with extended care and sober living, transitional living, and they're pretty competitive, cool places that you can go to for a period of time, and the average good successful outcome is 4 to 6 months after primary care. And I stay with the family. Their boundaries are shifting. Roles are shifting. They're going back to some form of homeostasis, back to norm. And the kids or their loved ones is going to challenge their recovery once they get back in the community. And just a whole lot of things are happening.
Do these opiate kids need a longer term, generally need a longer term treatment or a longer term, a longer process of staying involved in some kind of treatment and aftercare than, say, other addictions?
Throughout the course of treatment and what we're doing in treatment moving forward, is it's recognized, and it's no hidden secret, that opiate-dependent people statistically are super high for relapse early on.
Right, right.
And also opiate-dependent people don't understand what's going to hit them 6-8 months down the road with other post-acute withdrawal syndromes that are going to start presenting, like using dreams and new cravings that are going to happen in different parts of the body because of endorphins and rejuvenation of endorphins that could trigger another using episode. So, yeah.
So it's more important for them to stay involved in some kind of professional treatment or some kind of treatment
good
modality.
Good coaching, good monitoring,
yeah.
good extended care, staying in a,
that's why
in a light wraparound, a clinical.
So, yeah.
It all depends on the person on,
yeah.
And where they're at.
Okay,
life
so
skills.
You see them all the way into some kind of longer-term
mm-hmm.
longer-term
yeah.
treatment?
So to sustain early sobriety,
yeah.
what we do is another therapeutic move from a primary care. We have transport people all across the country that are facilitating moves from primary care to extended care to keep our person that is starting to think
right.
and correct and check and
right.
so on and so forth.
All right, so let's switch gears for just because we don't have a whole lot of time
mm-hmm.
left, but I wanted to talk a little bit about Invictus Woods.
Oh, okay.
And the place that you've started here
yep.
in near Peoria.
Invictus Woods is a 35-acre campus located in mid-central Illinois. I had a pretty successful adventure starting Fresh Start in
mm-hmm.
an urban model, and I had the opportunity to work with a family whose two kids got into recovery through intervention, and one of the sons is facilitating some of the activities on the Invictus Woods campus. And
that's Nick.
That's Nick.
Hi, Nick.
Hi, Nick. So, anyhow, Invictus Woods is a country model. It's
mm-hmm.
it's what we call a soft landing.
Mm.
Throughout the course of treatment, these young adult guys I recognize that they can't hold recovery in an urban environment, and they need a graduation
mm-hmm.
back into community at a slower pace because of things that are lacking in their sobriety as far as life skills,
mm-hmm.
money management, just all different things
mm-hmm.
that happen to people that aren't taken care of in their using days. So Invictus Woods is a 35-acre campus.
Mm. And I've seen pictures.
It's beautiful. A beautiful 5,500
yeah.
square foot
yeah.
Cape Cod 10 boy program.
I saw the hardwood floors that you put in with your
Thank
own
you.
With your own hands.
It's awesome. It's just a 90-day
yeah.
step down model, 90
yeah.
day or longer.
Yeah.
There's structure. There's community involvement. There's criteria that you need to respect as far as rules and behaviors and so on and so forth. And we have our wraparound clinical around the circumference of the campus, and
mm-hmm.
it's a fun place to get well if you enjoy the outdoors,
mm-hmm.
spring, summer, winter, or fall.
You got path. You said you have.
We have awesome trails around
yeah.
the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Nick has done a great job grooming those trails.
Mm-hmm.
We're brand new. Just started accepting referrals in September, and just going.
And this was kind of a dream of yours, wasn't it?
It was a dream
yeah.
of mine.
I mean, it's a perfect fit.
And recovery
for
is a journey, and my
do.
Journey took me to the woods,
sure.
and
yeah.
and I met this really cool family, and Dr. Ron Rabjohns and his wife Camilla wanted to get back to recovery.
Mm-hmm.
That family spent damn near $500,000 trying to get both their boys right
mm-hmm.
Throughout the course of time, and I'm grateful to have them.
If somebody wanted to get, what would they do, go to the website? Invictus
yeah, you could
Woods?
Go to InvictusWoods.com.
Right.
And the middle of January, we're going to have a newer website with new features and things of that nature, and all the buildings done,
yeah.
better pictures, but InvictusWoods.com.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the intervention side of things? What's
the intervention side of things, I'm opening up a branch office in the northwest suburbs of Chicago to help with communities that are seeing on TV that no longer is the disease super potent and powerful in Chicago proper, and there's a need for people like us. That other side of my business is called Bridgeback Interventions. I'm
mm-hmm.
going to help with other clinicians around the northwest suburbs with treatment placement, coordination, and intervention.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because
and same way they get a hold of you by going to Bridgeback.
Bridgebackinterventions.com or
okay, all right. I think that's you know at least people know how to get a hold of you.
Or they can find you through or find me through you.
Yeah, they can. Yeah, we'll have to get our websites hooked up and
yeah,
do all that technical stuff that I don't have a friggin' clue how to do.
Okay,
that'll be your job, Chris.
I keep busy.
You keep busy. You can do that.
I can do that.
So you think we covered most of the ground we intended to cover tonight?
Well, there's always more time down the road.
Yeah, we'll do it again. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'll do it again, and I'm sure we'll be in contact.
Thanks again for having me, Rick. I'm grateful. Yeah. Again, 17 years ago we crossed paths, and I really wasn't ready to become your friend yet. And
yeah, it only took 17 years.
And it only took, you know, it's like you told another friend of mine that had to go on a 26-year journey.
That's right.
I saw a couple weeks ago. It's like, well, here you are. Eventually you're going to find me.
I think he has the record so far. Anyway, thank you for coming tonight, Ryan.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it and sharing your stuff. And also, it's too bad Rob couldn't make it, but we'll get him to come. Maybe the next time, maybe the two of you will talk.
He had a commitment. I got an email on that. That's okay.
So I want to thank our listeners out there in Internet Radio Land for listening in tonight, mm-hmm. or listening in to the archives later if you're going to do that. And thanks to the studio audience. Thank you guys for coming tonight.
Yeah.
It was a great show. We really appreciate it. Good information. We'll email out reminders for next week's show sometime late next week. It seems to get later and later depending upon the week, but we'll give it a shot to get it out on Thursday. So remember to check Recovery Internet Radio. That's
recoveryinternetradio.com
for all the archive shows and to sign up for our email reminder list. And remember, too, that we want to hear from you so we know where you are and who the heck is listening to the show. We really would like to know. So as always, live today. Love yourself and your neighbor, and together we'll trudge the happy road to destiny. And we hope you've enjoyed the show. We'll see you at 7 p.m. next Sunday night. Good night.
That was fun.